On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Today, on The Lines Between Us, we continue our examination of economic opportunity in the Baltimore region with a look at workplace diversity. In a few minutes, we'll talk to a vice president and a board member of the Baltimore Community Foundation's Task Force on Race, Equity, and Inclusion. First, Baltimore writer and independent consultant Rodney Foxworth. Back in March, there was a technology event in Baltimore called N-Squared, short for Inclusive Innovation. At his blog, Rodney reacted to N-Squared with a reflection about diversity and inclusiveness in the tech world's, quote, white male nerd culture, unquote. We were intrigued by this line. Quote, N-Squared is an example of moving away from we tried to make it diverse to a much more instructive help us make this inclusive, close quote. We ask Rodney Foxworth to elaborate on that difference for us.
Periodically, someone or some organization asks for my advice on how to become more diverse. Here's how that question sounds to me. Rodney, how can I be less white? That's an awkward role for a 28-year-old black guy to play. Even more so in a majority-minority city like Baltimore. My friend, the Baltimore Sun columnist Lionel Foster, calls it translating. For members of most minority groups, cultural dexterity seems to be a matter of survival. It's not an option or something you ask someone to help you with. Inevitably, I find myself translating between black and white Baltimore, helping people to better understand and communicate with the other side, though most often for white Baltimore. I don't ever recall a black professional woman asking me, "Can you help me be more intentional with my relationships with white people?" Even in a majority black city like Baltimore, it's sort of a given that minority groups have to navigate these complex racial realities. These complex realities often get filed away under the term diversity. But diversity to me is an outcome of inclusiveness. Inclusiveness is about being welcoming and open to differing ideas and people. So again, diversity is an outcome of inclusiveness. And this usually gets lost on people. If your office environment or event is not inclusive, it won't be diverse. But everyone, most people, most institutions, believe themselves to be inclusive. Of course, we're all lying to ourselves, since inclusiveness requires us to constantly reevaluate and reassess ourselves and our networks. It reminds me of the HBO show Girls. Yeah, I went there. Critics have blasted the show because the main characters lack friends of color. And I giggle at that. Yes, giggle. People often get offended by fiction when it reflects reality. I know young ladies like the ones on Girls, and they don't have black friends. And there's a difference between diversity and inclusiveness. Inclusiveness would be Lena Dunham embracing a world that's less white. Diversity would be a show with more minority characters. Without the former, you won't have the latter. And that's why Girls doesn't make me uncomfortable, but does make a lot of young white Americans uncomfortable. Go figure. We all lie to ourselves about matters of inclusiveness and diversity. And usually, we don't even know we're doing it. It's subtle. And it's hard not to do. We're generally attracted to people like us. Example, there's a wonderful event organized by colleagues of mine called Create Baltimore. It's a platform for people building creative community in the city. The event generally has a low attendance of people of color, and they've been criticized for it. The organizers are looking to change it, because the implicit question is, do you not want to create a Baltimore with black people? You know, the other 63%. Morgan State professor Ray Winbush has said you can live your whole life in the city and never realize it was majority black. It's true. I remember talking with a prominent Baltimore businessman whose jaw dropped when I pointed out that the city was almost 65% black. Baltimore, so diverse, so segregated, and not going the way of DC anytime soon. This is exacerbated by our tendency to outsource diversity. I've literally had diversity outsourced to me. I've worked as a consultant to help overwhelmingly white companies improve their diversity. I did my work for them and moved on. It's like that across the working world. Rather than embody that act of inclusiveness or critically assess what we might be doing wrong, let's get someone else to figure it out and then return to business as usual. Being inclusive and achieving diversity is hard work, yes, because it requires us to abandon our comfort zones. But it's also surprisingly easy. Do you have trouble attracting women to your company with its male-dominated, bro'd-out culture? Do you lack critical skills and perspectives at your organization because everyone has the same degree, the very same degree you happen to possess? It's actually not as difficult for us to recognize how parochial our lives are, but it requires intentionality and a long look in the mirror. Inclusiveness and diversity questions make people defensive and uncomfortable, and they should. If you're not forced to question the incompleteness of your monolithic universe, you likely never will.
Rodney Foxworth. He's a Baltimore writer and organizational consultant. We'll link to more of his writing at linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. Our series has turned its focus from fair housing to economic opportunity with a look last week at the various ways Baltimore's minority entrepreneurs found support for their ventures when banks were denying them commercial credit. Today we're talking about diversity in the workplace. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 states that employers cannot, quote, fail or refuse to hire, unquote, because of an individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Nearly 50 years later, the demographics of our region are still not fully reflected in the demographics of our workplaces. You'd think that the nonprofit sector would have made the most progress in matters of equity, a goal implicit in many of their missions. But according to a 2010 Urban Institute report, although 70% of Baltimore City's population is people of color, they make up just 30% of people on the boards of nonprofits. Today, we've invited a staff member and a board member from the Baltimore Community Foundation to talk about an effort they've launched to become more inclusive as an organization. Disclosure, BCF is one of many funders of this series. BCF is a philanthropic foundation that organizes grants, initiatives, and advocacy for the region. Even before it helped fund this series, we had heard about its task force on race, equity, and inclusion and wanted to learn more. In the studio with me is Dinesta Hunt, Vice President for Community Investment at BCF. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also here is Harry Johnson. He's an attorney with Whiteford Taylor in Preston, and he's a member of the board of the Baltimore Community Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dinesta, I understand this task force started with a survey. Tell me how it got started.
Yes, this task force was actually an outgrowth of our strategic planning process, which we undertook a good 2 years ago now. We hired an outside team of consultants to do a set of focus groups, one-on-one interviews, and surveys with our stakeholders. And once the task force took a look at that data, the conversation led to, out of all these conversations that we've had, the issue of race never was raised explicitly. And the conversation then led to, if we really want to make our mark and to change outcomes for Baltimore City, we really have to wrestle with the issue of race and racial disparities. And thus, the task force was created from that conversation.
Harry Johnson, you are co-chair of the board's Race, Equity, and Inclusion Initiative, along with architect Steve Zeiger.
That's correct.
You're black, he's white. Was that a conscious decision?
I think it was more than conscious because initially I declined being co-chair of the committee when I was asked by the chair of the board. This issue was really surfaced by some of the African-American members of the board, and we didn't want to be in the position that the black person is always raising this issue about diversity. So I said if the board wants to show ownership, it should be some of the white leadership of the board that are talking about these hard issues, not just the African-American members of the board. But when Steve agreed to be the chair, he said, Harry, if you agree to be co-chair with me, then I'll be willing to take this effort on. And I'll tell you, he's been a fabulous co-chair, asking some of the very hard questions that I think need to be asked in this process.
Dinesta, does the board and staff feel prepared to take on these issues?
I think initially we did not. And when we started this work, the first thing that we decided to do was that education was first and foremost, that we really needed to have everyone understand the same language and context as we started the work. I think some of the first conversations were about structural racism and institutional racism. And I think when folks originally start to talk about race and racism, I think people initially want to go to the personal level and talk about ways in which they are not racist. And we wanted to be clear that that wasn't where we were starting our conversation, that our conversations were to focus on institutions and structures. Because as a community foundation, we support organizations that work with systems like the school system, like housing. So we wanted to have people look at how race and racial disparities have impacted things like housing policies and education policies.
Are you seeing results?
Well, that's part of the process. We're both jumping on that because that's part of the process. The talking part is good, but one of the other things that we really sought to do was to have some way to measure whether we were making any progress on what we were doing. One of the first things we did was an internal scan of our organization. How inclusive are we? How are opportunities presented? When we advertise a job, are we giving a broad opportunity? Where are we putting the job advertisement? Is it reaching a broader community or is it reaching a certain segment of the community so that other people don't have the opportunity to apply for the job? So we decided we were going to be very intentional. The vendors that we use at the organization, are they diverse? Do they have diverse people working on our account? When we ask the question, is your staff diverse? That makes the vendor go back and think about what they're doing in their organization. And they know they have to come back to Harry Johnson and answer the question. But being intentional about asking the question about whether we're inclusive, even naming our committee not the Diversity Task Force, but the Race, Equity, and Inclusion Task Force was intentional because inclusion is the goal we're looking for. The diversity is probably the measurement. When you look at the end and you look at our board, which has been very intentional about recruiting people for the board looks very different now than it looked 6 years ago.
But in addition to diversity and having those individuals on the board, I think we also were purposeful about looking at leadership. So it's great to have a diverse group of folks on the board, but are they in leadership positions? Do they sit on the Committee on Trustees, which looks at recruitment? Do they hold offices on the board? So diversity is, for me, the necessary but not sufficient. So I think you have to be purposeful about getting a diverse group of individuals on board and staff who represent the community. But then the next step is, do those folks have access to making decisions and policies.
And one of the other residual effects of this is that we make grants to people. We are training our grantees on these issues. So that's another measurement. We've learned the language and now we're providing tools to the people in the community so that they understand how structural racism and these issues affect the work that they want to do in their community so that they can be more effective in their community group.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Donesta Hunt, Baltimore Community Foundation's Vice President for Community Investment, and Harry Johnson, an attorney at Whiteford Taylor and Preston, who serves on BCF's board. It seemed to me Rodney Foxworth, in his essay we heard earlier, seemed to me to be saying, change your attitude to be more inclusive and the diverse hires will follow. And I would have thought that populating staff and especially board with people of color is the way you get to be. Have a shared inclusive attitude. It's a question, I guess, of which comes first.
Well, I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, because if you just look at diversity, that's almost like placeholders. So we do a count and we have, it's almost like a quota. We have X number of that category on our board. That doesn't affect policy. That doesn't affect whether you have an investment in the issue of including people. On the other hand, if you have a board which is educated and wants to be inclusive, I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. I also chair a hospital board in this community, and we did a CEO search about 2 years ago. Not only did we ask for an inclusive search firm, but we told the search firm that we wanted an inclusive list of candidates. We didn't want totally white males as candidates. So the search firm was a woman-owned search firm. She brought us the final six candidates were a diverse group of candidates. And that's because not only me as a member of that search committee, but the other members of the search committee thought having a diverse panel of candidates was important to us. So that's not the end result. That's the process. But that gave a number of people the opportunity to apply for their job. The inclusion, being included in the selection process, having the chance to interview, so that when we got down to the final candidates, we chose a great candidate, I have to tell you, but we were very pleased with the process because we had a selection and we were open, and people who observed our process thought that we were very inclusive in the people that we sought to interview. That's a tool that I learned from going through this stuff with the BCF, but now I've applied it both there and in my law firm. We're doing the same type of work. So I think these tools that the board members are getting by this process we're under are something that will help them in their own foundations, but ultimately it's going to help this community because more people understand these barriers we're talking about from structural racism.
We've been talking about race. I want to raise another question. It seems to me there is a class element to this also. Many of the region's nonprofits focus on poor neighborhoods, but many of the boards and staff of those nonprofits don't live in those neighborhoods. They live in middle class or upper class neighborhoods. On Twitter, a young man named Adam Jackson, who's the CEO of a group called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, has been protesting what he calls, quote, the nonprofit industrial complex. He tweeted, quote, white liberals control most, if not all, of the grant money that flows through Baltimore. And, quote, we should not put that power in the hand of white people who have no stake in the hood. Close quote. Jackson seems to feel that organizers from poor black neighborhoods are excluded. And I wonder, when BCF talks about inclusion, whether that particular manifestation of a line between us, as we call the series, is part of the conversation.
I think it has been from the very inception, but I think it's even preceded our work on race, equity, and inclusion, because in our neighborhoods committee, which I served on, there's always the issue of, are we dictating to people what they need, or are we addressing the needs of the community? And that gets to that class question. Is the foundation sitting there telling people this is what you need? And so in the grant process, people submit grants for needs and they tell us what their needs are, and there's certain criteria they have to meet to do that. I think that's a legitimate question, but I don't necessarily agree with the conclusion that he comes to, because if the community foundation was not raising this money and directing this money to the community, then where would it come from? That's the first question I would pose. And then the second thing I would say is that it's still one community, even though it's made up of a lot of different communities. So putting money into the community, in different communities, helping those communities be cleaner and greener and safer, helps the entire city. No one likes seeing trash on a street in a community when you're driving downtown. That affects everyone in the community. So if the communities get grant money to plant flowers and to clean up the sidewalks or to clean up a vacant lot in their neighborhood, then that affects everyone in the community. And that really helps all classes in the community. It's not to the disadvantage of one class or to the advantage of another.
Thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you. Dinesta Hunt is Vice President for Community Investment at BCF. Harry Johnson is an attorney with Whiteford, Taylor & Preston. He serves on the Baltimore Community Foundation's board. What's your workplace doing to become more inclusive? Do you have other stories to share about equality of economic opportunity in our region? Please share them with us. It's easy. Just go to linesbetweenus.org, all one word, linesbetweenus.org, and click on the Your Stories link. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. The sounds of solstice. Helicon is here. Stay with us on 88.1. Before we go, a note about the lines between us and gun violence. We realize that gun violence plays out in different communities in different ways. Maryland has been spared the horrific concentration of death visited on Newtown, Connecticut last week. But on average, once a week, month after month, so many neighborhoods in our state lose a child or a teenager to guns. And much more often than not, those children are black or Hispanic. Over the last decade, the gun homicide rate for black Maryland children between ages 10 and 14 was twice that for white children. Among black teenagers older than 14, the rate of those killed by guns was 23 times that of whites. As our series, The Lines Between Us, continues next year, we intend to learn more about what's behind the gun violence that takes the lives of so many children and what some people are doing to stop it.